Hey, before we get into today's episode, I just want to let you know that my candle shop, Nox and Vesta, has just recently released three new scents, the Isles, Persephone, and Koi. The Isles smells like if you were to visually see a river flowing through a beautiful green forest with lots of moss and trees. Persephone smells like a lot of dark fruit and pomegranate. It's really kind of a unique scent. And Koi, of course, is called Koi because it's honeysuckle playing koi. It's a honeysuckle candle that I think just has a little bit of a twist that makes it a little more fun. Make sure to check it out at noxvesta.com, N-O-X-V-E-S-T-A.com. You may know him as the guy who has hair dye melting down his face. Or even the guy who may have been drunk on a 9/11 anniversary speech. Or maybe you even know him as America's mayor, a beloved hero who confronted a horrific tragedy head on. These days, Rudy Giuliani is an extremely controversial figure thanks to his claims surrounding voter fraud and unwavering support of Donald Trump. But how did this happen, and is his fall from grace really all that surprising? Let's take a look and see if we can find out where America's mayor started to falter and if he ever really deserved the respect he had in the first place.
Having gone through this experience, I kind of have a philosophy that goes something like this.
What the hell is wrong with you? Who pays you? That is crazy. Under oath.
Stop. Nonsense.
I know it's not a crime to lie to us in the media.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Corporate Casket. I'm the Illuminati, and today we're going to be talking about Rudy Giuliani and his background as a prosecutor, mayor, and the rise before the fall. I think this is pretty straightforward, so let's get into it. Let's rewind to the very groovy 1970s when Rudy Giuliani had finished law school. He was busy proving himself to be a motivated and even charismatic character, working extremely long hours at the state's attorney office. Giuliani says that the first year there, he tried 16 or 19 cases, and 10 months after getting the job, he couldn't remember ever having a Saturday off. Although the hours contributed to the eventual end of his first marriage, it paid off career-wise. At just 30 years old, he was the third-ranking prosecutor in the office, and he became involved in some high-profile cases. He became known for his intense cross-examination. New York Times reported that in a dramatic bribery trial, defendant representative Beltram Podell, quote, faltered, became so nervous he poked out his eyeglass lens, asked for a recess, and gave up, pleading guilty. Around this time, Giuliani's politics also began to change. He'd been a Democrat and even worked on Robert F. Kennedy's Senate campaign years prior. But in 1975, he voted Republican for the very first time, citing now-former senator presidential candidate George McGovern's dangerous views as a reason. Giuliani wasn't yet interested in politics, though admitted to having political aspirations. The New York Times speculated that his combativeness, while great for being a prosecutor, might make him a less appealing candidate down the line. Still, during the 70s and 80s, Giuliani seemed to be making all the right moves to benefit his career. He made friends with Attorney General Smith and worked in the New York City Southern District office, where cases from the FBI and IRS might land on his desk. As a United States Associate Attorney General, Giuliani represented the federal government on behalf of the Attorney General in court, giving him all the more connections. And he was making good money, too, though there were always those that weren't too keen on him. For example, in 1981, the FBI's Columbo investigation began. The case surrounded extortion from construction and restaurant businesses and two federal offices, the one where Giuliani worked and one in the Eastern District. They agreed to prosecute the case together. These high-profile FBI and IRS cases could overlap between the Southern and Eastern Districts at times. However, during indictments, only one office can be in control, and with the Columbo case, the Eastern District wanted it. They made the argument that virtually every act was in the Eastern District. Almost all defendants also lived in the Eastern District, and they claimed they did at least half the work. So, I suppose that makes sense, right? Justice Department officials thought so too, and the Eastern District was recommended by mid-level officials at the time. However, Giuliani wanted the case so badly that he went over these mid-level officials' heads and went straight to the top officials in Washington to win the case for his office. The Eastern District prosecutor was gracious and admitted that, quote, I can't fault the agencies for seeing in Rudy a power base and a source of influence they don't see in me. Still, this was quite the power move. Whether you believe it showed Giuliani's greed or simply demonstrated that his words spoke volumes, or perhaps a mixture of the two, there's no denying that he clearly had some level of power as a noteworthy prosecutor. By 1983, that clout grew exponentially when he made the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. In other words, he would represent the country in federal court now, not on behalf of someone else. With recognized crime being prevalent, this gave Giuliani even more access to the spotlight. The Mop Museum explains that around this time, Giuliani said going after organized crime in New York was his top priority, and a year after he was appointed to the role, there were 350 FBI agents and 100 New York police detectives investigating the mob. Another year later, in 1985, he used RICO, or the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to prosecute the leaders of these mob families. This was the first time it was used in federal court. Literally hundreds of witnesses were called to the case and went to trial, and Giuliani dealt the New York Mafia a crippling blow as a result when the lengthy prison sentences were handed out. With 4,125 convictions and only 25 reversals, Giuliani became one of the most effective U.S. attorneys in American history. One New York Times article from 1985 opens as follows. The woman cannot believe it. She is in the same elevator as Rudolph Giuliani, the federal prosecutor for Manhattan. You're Rudolph Giuliani, she says. Oh, I can't believe it. You're the one in the papers with the mob. She is staring. Oh, this is a thrill. Frankly, Giuliani replies, I'm surprised you're not worried about riding the elevator with me. It is a line he often uses at speaking engagements. He knows joking about death threats is almost always good for a big laugh. And this article was honestly pretty invaluable to my research. I wanted to understand how people viewed him during this time as a prosecutor and the impact that he had on them. With an opener like that, it's pretty clear that he'd become a household name. The Italian government gave him an award for battling the mafia. He was on television practically every night of the week, and the Thomas E. Dewey Association made him their speaker. However, even behind the scenes, things weren't always as they appeared. Giuliani would apparently handcuff mob members for trumped-up charges and basically parade them around so that he looked good and would only drop the charges later. Police also said that even though drug dealing went way down in some areas, much of it just relocated. Notre Dame law professor J. Robert Blakely, who helped draw up the anti-racketeering laws of the time, also argued that Giuliani was simply taking credit for 20 years' worth of massive law enforcement campaigns. It's like stuffing a pipe. You put it in at one end, and for a long time you don't see anything. And then it finally shows. Rudolph Giuliani is the lucky guy enough to be standing at the end of the pipe, he said. That's not to say Giuliani didn't stop crime whatsoever, but perhaps he was taking more credit than deserved. Another Giuliani critic, Gerald Stern, of the state's Commission of Judicial Conduct, said that his increased use of press conferences was creating an unhealthy atmosphere in the New York legal community. Prosecutors are competitive with each other. Everyone's grabbing for attention, he stated. Giuliani countered by saying he was just trying to be open with the public, and his second wife told the New York Times that he was just like this with everyone and he loved to stay up talking for hours with his friends too. And as a brief aside, his second wife, Regina, was also apparently his second cousin, which caused some scandal, but as off-putting as this is, we're going to focus more on his professional life than his personal one. Just wanted to give you a little tidbit of knowledge there. A few years later, Giuliani wanted even more impact. Perhaps he wanted to make a bigger change for the people of New York, or perhaps he wanted a bigger spotlight. Either way, Giuliani decided to run for mayor. Now, his public image was put under a microscope. Even more people stepped forward to say that he was just in the right place at the right time. People like Ronald Goldstock, director of the state's Organized Crime Task Force, essentially reiterated what we heard Blakey said a moment ago. Some officials claimed that judges resented how Giuliani turned indictments into media events. The chief of the Organized Crime Unit before Giuliani said that he was basically selfish, stating, "The overwhelming perception was that what was good for him, what was going to be done. If it was going to put him in the most positive light and give him the image he wanted, it was going to be done." A professor at the New York University Law School and former national litigation director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Bert Newbern, told the New York Times in 1989, "People were caught up in the view of him as a Superman or a devil. The truth is, he was neither. He was a pretty good prosecutor who made some mistakes." Once again, Giuliani countered these claims and said that no one saw him as infallible, and his reputation was earned for his hard work. Perhaps he wasn't infallible, but Giuliani was about as close as someone could get. His name was recognized by 40% of New Yorkers in 1986. Ultimately, Rudy mania did win out. Giuliani may have had his critics, but whether his attention-seeking and competitive nature were malicious or helpful to his career, he was able to win the public over enough to become mayor a few years later.
Rudolph Giuliani, who came closer to getting elected than anybody thought. Well, he's not one to just fade away. There is talk he'll run for senator against Al D'Amato, or even for governor against Mario Cuomo.
Said to all the people that voted for me that the election is over and that you have to support the winner of the election. That's what the process is all about. The city has very, very grave problems.
So far, we've only discussed Rudy Giuliani, the prosecutor. Giuliani, the mayor, however, is an entirely different story. The scandals began even before he was officially elected. In July 1989, he filed two challenges against cosmetics heir Ron Lauder, his primary opponent. According to the New York Daily News, he accused Lauder of faking petition signatures, but when the case went to court, a judge determined there was no merit. Giuliani didn't win the first run he ran either. He was beaten by David Norman Dinkins, the first black mayor of New York City. Once more, Giuliani made baseless claims. Critic Wayne Barnett said that Giuliani's election night party was, quote, filled with ugly untruths about how blacks had stolen the election at polls in Harlem and Bed-Stuy, where the dead had supposedly voted by the thousands. And yes, that is a quote, very unfortunately. Though he did concede, Giuliani didn't seem to be a gracious loser. Years later, he again said that some people voted 8 or 9 times. And does that sound familiar? Because Giuliani made very similar claims about the 2020 election, too. But I digress. Let's fast forward a few years. In 1992, Giuliani was running again. As you might expect any political candidate to do, he critiqued the policies of his opponent, the current Mayor Dinkins. Giuliani spoke to a massive crowd one day in September, a crowd that was largely off-duty police officers. They'd been protesting Dinkins' plan for an all-civilian police oversight board. Giuliani told the crowd, "The reason the morale of the police department of the city of New York is so low is one reason and one reason alone, David Dinkins." It became absolute chaos and actually sparked riots, even on-duty officers doing little to police the crowd. This was a stark contrast from the idea of what we would say was peaceful protest. This actually became one of the largest riots in New York City history. As many as 10,000 people took part. Reporters and innocent bystanders were assaulted. Thousands of dollars in private property were destroyed, and they blocked traffic in both directions on the Brooklyn Bridge. And you're gonna find this last little bit interesting. And protesters stormed right up to City Hall. Many of them were carrying guns and drinking as well. A Newsday columnist, Jimmy Breslin, described the racist conduct as well, writing, "The cops held up several of the most crude drawings of Dinkins performing perverted sex acts, and then here was one of them calling across the top of the beer can to his mouth, 'How do you like the N-word beating you up in Crown Heights?'" The man shouting at Breslin was referring to a time when the columnist had been beaten covering a 1991 riot in Crown Heights. The man also called Dinkins an N-word mayor, and other members of the crowd, again, many of them white off-duty cops, began screaming the N-word right along with him. Giuliani never condemned the riots, the signs, or the cops. And in my opinion, and small tangent here, but I think Giuliani absolutely helped incite these riots. Whether or not he knew they would get this bad, there's no doubt in my mind that he contributed to the cause of them. Therefore, it's his responsibility to condemn them, and he didn't. The fact that he didn't speaks volumes to his character. And worse than that, I think it's really telling and frustrating that I literally had to specify which riot I was researching to Google when looking this up because the insurrection kept showing up as well, which is no surprise. Not only does this riot mirror the January 6th insurrection, but the frivolous lawsuits and accusations of voter fraud reflect another as well. Giuliani has apparently always been this way. The very next year, despite literally inciting a riot, Giuliani was elected. He only won by a thin margin, about 2%, but he promised his supporters that his administration would be universal in its concern, sensitive to our diversity, and even-handled in every possible way. He added that no one, regardless of ethnicity, race, or religion, would escape his care, concern, and attention. Not everyone was so quick to believe him, though, especially those whose ballots weren't even counted yet. The New York Times reported that 28,500 absentee ballots were waiting to be opened on November 12th, about a week after the article was published. 20,000 were still outstanding, and there were an undetermined number of paper ballots cast the previous day because of disputes. Once more, accusations of voting fraud began to circle. Dinkins accused Giuliani of voter intimidation, presenting three unproven allegations of how hundreds of posters urging a Dinkins vote in English and Spanish were put in Washington Heights and the Bronx. The 1993 article reports that posters suggested illegal immigrants would be arrested at the polls and deported if they tried to vote. Considering that Giuliani was largely popular among white voters and Dinkins was popular with voters of color, these intimidation tactics, if legitimate, could have definitely impacted Dinkins' numbers. However, it's important to recognize that these claims were unsubstantiated. Giuliani accused Dinkins of retreating into, quote, black victimization, while Dinkins' campaign manager likened Giuliani to David Duke, a former infamous KKK member. Needless to say, things were quite tense and bitter from the very start. Now, when Giuliani did become mayor, he promised to be tough on crime, which, given his background, made sense. However, the way in which he did it, well, let's just say it makes far less sense. He very strongly believed in the broken windows policy. Now, I'm not going to go too in-depth into this because I've already talked about it in great length during my hostile architecture episode, but to briefly summarize, the broken windows theory says that seemingly minor instances of social and physical disorder in urban spaces can contribute to an atmosphere of lawlessness. Unfortunately, this does not mean that Giuliani was calling for neighborhood cleanups or architectural repairs. Instead, he was cracking down on squeegee men that offer unsolicited windshield washing, vandalism, and other relatively minor crimes. Giuliani told the press in 1998, "Obviously, murder and graffiti are two vastly different crimes, but they are part of the same continuum, and a climate that tolerates one is more likely to tolerate the other." Giuliani also appointed Bill Bratton as police commissioner, who started to incorporate the stop, question, and frisk tactics that would later reach their peak under Giuliani's successor, Mayor Bloomberg. These stop and frisk policies allow police officers to, as the name suggests, stop and frisk anyone they suspect of committing or attempting to commit a crime, regardless of any evidence to prove it. During his first presidential campaign, Trump praised these tactics and said, quote, "Rudy Giuliani did a great job as mayor, and they really straightened things out with stop and frisk, and it was used further by the next mayor, Bloomberg." Trump and other advocates for these policies say that they worked. Crime did drop in New York City under Giuliani's watch. Murders per 100,000 residents went from almost 16 people to about 4 in the mid-90s. Violent crimes plummeted at a similar rate. So clearly, something Giuliani did was working, right? Well, it wasn't these stop and frisk policies. There's almost no correlation in data between stop and frisk and crime. Crime in New York rapidly declined after 1990, even before Giuliani became mayor, and stop and frisks peaked at a significant time after crime dropped. Studies found that there was no effect between stop and frisk and robberies and burglaries whatsoever. Plus, 80 to 90% of those that were stopped absolutely did nothing wrong. Black people and Latino people were also far more likely to be subject to stop and frisk policies, while ironically enough, white people were one-third more likely to actually be carrying an illegal weapon when they were stopped. About two decades later, in 2013, the infamous policy was found unconstitutional, as Judge Shira ruled they violate the Fourth Constitution's amendment that prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. So now let's go back to Bratton for just a moment. Surely he would have seen that stop and frisks were not working. After all, he also helped implement and helped create a system called CompStats, or Data Management for Crime Statistics. Well, CompStat itself is actually pretty controversial too. When it was created, CompStat was meant to bring accountability as well as uphold the broken windows theory. 27 months after launching, major crimes had dropped 39%. This sounds promising, but Rosenfeld, a Missouri criminologist, argues it's the accountability that did this more than anything. Bratton had insisted commanders be held responsible for what was happening in their precincts. Plus, captains were now given quotas with enormous pressure. These facts, more than anything to do with fixing broken windows per se, are what Rosenfeld attributes to the drop in crime. Other articles point out the police force grew by 35% in the 1990s and the number of prison inmates rose by 24%. Giuliani wasn't necessarily right about murder and graffiti either. The thing is, his tough-on-crime policies that handed out lengthier sentences for misdemeanors meant that yes, there were fewer people going out and putting graffiti on walls. However, studies also show that misdemeanor arrests don't impact murder, assault, and burglary charges. It's a far cry from graffiti to murder, in other words, and it seems wildly irresponsible that Giuliani, as a mayor, did not recognize this. Once again, we see skeptics arguing that Giuliani was effectively taking credit for being at the end of the pipe. Violent crime began falling 3 years before he took office. Studies have failed to link his tactics with decreasing crime rates, and even if policing tactics might have been a part of it, there's almost no way they were a driving force. Jeffrey Fagan, co-director and the Center for Crime, Community, and Law at Columbia Law School in New York even stated, "Demographics have an awful lot to do with this, and these are very, very large social forces. It's hard to imagine policing, no matter how smart and effective it is, giving the kind of leverage to move a macro force like crime." Plus, Giuliani's city wasn't even the only city that experienced a dramatic drop in crime at the time. San Diego, Chicago, and Miami all had the same thing happen, and it seems incredibly unlikely, if not impossible, that this was all conveniently Giuliani's doing. However, what some argue is Giuliani's doing is the rise in police brutality at the time. The book Zero Tolerance, Quality of Life and the New Police Brutality in New York City was published in 2001. It tells another side of the story as to how things changed under Giuliani and reads, "Evidence of public hostility towards police and the increasing rate of police misconduct are born out of the rise in civilian complaints since zero tolerance was introduced. The filings of civil rights claims against the police for abusive conduct increased by 75% between 1994 and 1998, according to the New York civil rights attorney. During the summer of 1999, reports began to surface that after a nearly two-year-long injury to the NYPD, investigators from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York were about to issue a report that the department's failure to discipline officers created an atmosphere that fostered brutality. And let me go ahead and issue a very brief content warning here that the next couple minutes or so we'll be discussing police brutality in some graphic detail. Please feel free to skip forward if you're not in the right place to listen to that at this time. To summarize, Rudy Giuliani saw to it that the constitutional rights of people in New York City were trampled. His legacy was hallmarked by discrimination, police brutality, and, as the NYCLU puts it, he oversaw a policing regime repeatedly engaged in persecution and brutal assaults and killings of Black and Hispanic New Yorkers. They use the tragic death of Patrick Dorismond as an example. During Giuliani's time as mayor, Dorismond, a 26-year-old Black security guard and father of two, was killed by undercover police officers. Dorismond was unarmed, and as his witness-slash-colleague Kevin Kaiser told the New York Times, neither of them had any idea that the undercover officers in plain clothes were police. Apparently, the two security guards were waiting for a taxi when an undercover detective approached them, asking if they knew where they could buy marijuana. Angry words were exchanged, a scuffle erupted, and two more backup detectives approached. The word police was allegedly shouted before Dorismond was shot. Personally, I don't think just shouting the word police when the officers are in plain clothes and a scuffle has already erupted is really going to help anything. If I were in that situation, I would have assumed the individuals were shouting police as if they were saying, call the police, not to identify themselves. What made this case so upsetting wasn't just the fact about how unjustified and needless this was, but Giuliani's reaction to it all as well. According to the NYCLU, Giuliani attacked Dorismond's character and publicly revealed his legally sealed juvenile record. Consistently, Giuliani would blame the victim in cases like these, imply that they deserved it, and fail to address the police brutality he promoted. So, if so much of Giuliani's legacy is marred by hatred, how did he earn the title of America's mayor? Surely he must have done something right, right? Well, it turns out that that might be because of a little something called 9/11. And before we get into the events of 9/11, what happened, and what Giuliani did to earn this title of America's mayor, let's take a quick moment to thank today's sponsors. If you're anything like me, planning is an absolute necessity just to make it through the day. And when I'm saying planning, I'm planning everything. Everything's written down on whiteboards, I know what I'm doing, what I'm eating, and I know probably weeks in advance. That's why I really love HelloFresh. HelloFresh delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients to your door every single week, or if you don't want to do every single week, they can do it whenever it works for your schedule, which is great for someone like me. You can pick your favorites from 50 different weekly options and skip weeks when you need to, change your delivery date, or update your preferences all within the HelloFresh app, which is seriously the easiest thing in the world to use. And HelloFresh's chefs really know how to diversify the menu with seasonal recipes like salmon limon and pasta primavera. And HelloFresh even has fit and wholesome recipes for satisfying and nutritious meals that you can feel good about, with 6 recipes per week to choose from, including low-calorie and carb-conscious options too. So make sure you go to HelloFresh.com/casket16 and use code casket16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. Again, that's HelloFresh.com/casket16 and use code casket16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. Online shopping isn't slowing down anytime soon. So is your business ready to keep up the pace? Well, with ShipStation, you'll never have to worry about shipping again. Make the switch to a solution that handles all your shipping needs quickly, affordably, and painlessly. You can save time by funneling your orders into one simple interface. It doesn't matter if you're using Amazon, eBay, Etsy, or your own website. From anywhere, even from your phone. And ShipStation works with every carrier, so you can find the best fit for you. And this is kind of awesome. You are going to get the same types of discounted rates that are usually reserved for Fortune 500 companies. And that's why ShipStation is already trusted by over 100,000 other e-commerce sellers. It's easy to keep track of orders, you can find the best shipping carrier, and you can automate just about any shipping task with just a few clicks. So if you have a small business, if you just need to ship out a ton of mail from time to time, or whatever you're doing, make it easier with ShipStation. Use my offer code CASKET to get a 60-day free trial. That's 2 months free of no-hassle, stress-free shipping. Just go to ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and type in the word casket. ShipStation. Make ship happen. Before 9/11 happened, Giuliani was a lame duck hobbling about City Hall with one ailing foot in a protective boot. His divorce lawyer said nasty things about his estranged wife. He was openly dating another woman. He was sleeping in a spare bedroom at a friend's apartment, and there was a whiff of irrelevance about him, as the New York Times puts it. Giuliani had become sort of mediocre with a 50% approval rating. However, it was his reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks that cemented him as
America's mayor. He's the mayor of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, Rudy Giuliani.
So I thank you very much for your leadership on the ground.
In the wake of absolute terror and devastation, Giuliani became a beacon of hope for the city. He attended funerals, comforted survivors, and exuded compassion and resolve. People began to adore him again, chanting Rudy, Rudy, Rudy everywhere he went. Rudy even briefly floated the idea that he could serve a bit longer as mayor, though this wasn't meant to be, and Bloomberg took over in 2002. Still, the New York Times reported that as of September 2001, there were New Yorkers calling for an extension of his term by at least 6 months. Giuliani appeared more put together than the president at the time, George W. Bush, who seemed frozen in his chair when the attacks had taken place. Though I do want to note that George W. Bush was reading in front of kids when he found out, so I'm not really sure how anyone would have reacted if he had really let the kids know that something was going on. Frederick A.O. Schwartz Jr., the city's former corporation counsel, had this to say. That time was absolutely the best and worst of Rudy. Rudy stood up strong and rallied us, but that confidence created the very dangerous idea that we couldn't survive without him. Some argued this wasn't just dangerous, but a power grab in the wake of a crisis. Governor George Pataki later wrote, "Regardless of Rudy's motivation, regardless of his raw emotions in the situation, he abandoned some of his most basic conservative principles to follow the law and relinquish power when your term is over, even in times of crisis." And I understand that I have a bias against Giuliani because of his recent actions in the Trump administration and the January 6th insurrection. I don't know if Giuliani's intentions were good or bad when he suggested running for another term. But whether he was purposely slimy and manipulative, it's kind of messed up that he would ever suggest such a thing right after such a national tragedy. But regardless if Giuliani was actually indispensable or not, his actions during the 9/11 tragedy and the following anthrax scare seemed to overshadow his previous actions as a mayor. He became Times Person of the Year in 2001, with their article reading, "Mayor of the World." They wrote that he led a battered platoon of city officials, reporters, and civilians north through the blizzard of ash and smoke, depicting him as a hero. He was even offered to be knighted by the Queen too, and he later claimed that he turned it down because he would have to relinquish his U.S. citizenship to accept, though the LA Times stated in 2001 that he did receive the honorary knighthood, just not the title of Sir, since he isn't a UK citizen. Years later, Rudy even said that he'd been in ruins, as if not more, than cleanup workers. While Giuliani did truly encourage the city once more, he seemed to exaggerate his actual impact. While a record of his exposure to the site isn't available for September 11th to September 16th, the mayoral archive states that from September 17th to the end of his term as mayor, he spent a total of 29 hours at the site. Again, I don't want to invalidate the good things he did do, but to say that he might have been there as often, if not more, than the rescue and recovery teams that were putting in 12-hour daily shifts, I don't think so. He also told the Associated Press in 2006 that he was there 5 or 6 times a day for months. Either Giuliani is lying about that or the mayor records are inaccurate. Giuliani did apologize when he was called out for these comments and said he wasn't trying to suggest competition, but just wanted to say he was there with the citizens. Recovery workers have also said that Giuliani's push for a fast cleanup of the site didn't fully recognize the risks involved, and their long-term exposure to the toxins had serious illnesses. Yet all this paled in the face of his heroism. When Giuliani left the mayor's office, people were so eager to hear from America's mayor that he was able to charge a minimum of $100,000 per motivational speech. The Chicago Tribune wrote that in 2003, Giuliani charged twice as much, $200,000, for a speech meant to benefit an Australian research hospital. The hospital director later confirmed that the event itself had only brought in a mere fraction of what Giuliani charged, about $15,000. This whole situation actually led to a lawmaker in South Australian Parliament filing legislation that would require a charitable organization to disclose what percentage of a contribution is going towards a charity versus a speaker. In 2005, Giuliani requested $100,000 at another charity event. He donated $20,000 back to the charity, but his $80,000 paycheck from a charity still drew a fair bit of scrutiny, so he donated another $60,000. The following year, he even requested a private jet for transportation to Oklahoma State University, which the school paid $47,000 for. And these are just 3 examples that drew attention. There's nothing wrong with people hiring a motivational speaker if that's what you want, but it all seemed a bit excessive. Giuliani wasn't just profiting off of his title as America's mayor, but he was charging so much that people were spurred on to request laws that would disclose such information in the future. Plus, his other side deals started to catch other people's attention. For example, his investment bank, Giuliani Capital Advisors, charged 7-figure fees for providing advice on bankruptcy cases, to the point that the courts called this excessive compensation. Since Giuliani wanted to run for president, entering politics once more, questions arose if he'd disclose his clients or not for full transparency's sake. And once again, Giuliani seemed to be overestimating himself. He saw himself as a fantastic, incredible prosecutor when others have said he was fine, he just had good connections and made a show of things. He considered himself a fantastic mayor, even America's mayor, when the vast majority of his legacy is built on discrimination. Then, once he went into speaking, he was charging absolute top dollar. All of it just reeks of someone with a massive ego, and in my opinion, a tiny wee-wee. Can I get a little picture of those Vienna sausages? Because that's what I'm thinking about. Anyway, but sure enough, Giuliani wasn't content with being considered America's mayor. He wanted to be America's president. And when he couldn't have that, he decided he'd settle for having the ear of a president instead. Though that, of course, is going to be a continued story and a part two of this series on Rudy Giuliani. For another day, unfortunately. We will continue on with the series in just a few weeks with our part two continuing on into Rudy Giuliani in current day. But for the time being, that is where we are going to end part one discussing Rudy Giuliani. I hope you learned something new in today's episode, and if you did, make sure you're liking, following, and subscribing so you can stay up to date on all the latest episodes. I really appreciate you spending some of your time here with me today to be able to listen and hopefully learn something new about Rudy Giuliani, someone who claims to be America's mayor. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great rest of your day. Bye!